Mr. Feakins, Reel 5. We were talking about the events of the 27th of May, I think we'd reached the point really where you'd driven in, the armoured car had tipped forward into the slit trench, and the people from the other armoured car, Ivor Birkin's armoured car, came across to see what was happening. Now, you don't remember seeing Ivor particularly, although we believe he was there, but that's not a memory you have.
No, I remember his driver and his ACK, Sergeant Harold Harper, coming across to see if they could help, having received the radio message that we had been hit. And as I have previously mentioned, I tried to get the hell out of it by driving back to our lines. But I hit a slit trench, which of course was great impact, and went forward with my seat and damaged my back. At this particular time was when Harold Harper came to see if he could help. He, in fact, got the car out of the slit trench, which had been pinning down one of my radio operators, gunner right. And I'm very sorry to say that I broke his leg, but then, of course, I didn't realize that he had already gone into the slit trench. There's nothing I could do because my legs were getting weaker and weaker. And as I've already again said, that Harold Harper got the vehicle out and pulled right out. And at this time we were all feeling a little lost because Ivor Birkin's vehicle had then been hit.
Now, were you had Harold pulled you out of the armoured car then?
Yes, I was out of the armoured car at the back of it. The vehicle, of course, being stationary. And we were all a little lost because we had no way out. Both vehicles were inactive, his on fire, mine was all right, but it had, of course, three dead bodies in it. And a tank from the 3rd and 4th City of London Yeomanry came past. And we all jumped on it. At least I'm saying that I jumped is an overstatement. Yes, to say that I was lifted on is an absolute overstatement because my memory serves me right. It was Ivor Birkin's driver that lifted me on, and I'm very happy to say hung on to me because from my waist down I couldn't feel a thing.
Was the tank driver aware that you were there, or rather, you know, the tank crew, the tank commander?
I don't think they had any idea we were on the tank. I mean, we went on from the rear, and of course there's no vision unless somebody is up in the turret, and people don't usually stand up in the turret when there's shells and that whizzing around. So I was on the back, the driver of Ivor Birkin, Harold Harper, and I believe I'm right in saying Ivor Birkin was on it as well.
And Wright was on it, the signaller?
Yes, and Wright, the signaller with a broken leg. We travelled...
Were you still on... I mean, you'd been hit by people, by the Germans approaching from a dust cloud, which you thought you saw a vehicle.
That's right.
Had that resolved? Could you now see German vehicles or tanks, or were you not aware with everything else going on?
There was stuff flying around, but I don't think I could actually see them firing.
By stuff you mean you were under shell fire?
That's right, we were under shell
fire. What about machine guns, any?
No, I think they were more or less artillery fire, which of course would be coming from quite a distance away and we would have no vision of them.
Was the tank you were on firing?
I believe it fired once or twice, but it wasn't constant fire.
What was that like to be on the tank when it fired? Do you remember? Do you recall?
Give you a shook, a shake. Not words about that. But I think we were more concerned with our own affairs at this time, with a little bit of fear of God in us, because we were out in the open whilst the tank crew were on the inside.
How are you managing to hold on?
Well, I was very lucky because, as I mentioned, I had no feeling in my legs whatsoever. And the Ivor Birkin's driver was hanging on to me like grim death, which I shall always be very grateful. But I'm very sorry to say we hadn't gone very far when he was hit right across the bottom. And when you get hit like that in the cheeks of your ass, your immediate thing is to grab. And in doing this, of course, he let me go. And I immediately fell off the tank. The tank continued on its way, and I'm left out in the open, miles from anywhere, in no man's land. But there is a funny side to this little bit, in as much that where tanks turn in their tracks, they throw up a ridge. And that looked like a haven to me, and I was hiding behind the tank tracks. Nonsensically, of course, but to me it was a haven.
How high would it have been?
About 2 inches, I presume. It's hard to be precise at this time, but it was about that.
Now, what state were you in? You'd got your back, you wounded in the legs. Were they hurting yet, or?
Oh, yes, the pain had started to come in. Although I was had no use, I don't think it was paralyzed in the true form of being paralyzed. I just couldn't use them because I had a great gaping hole in my right leg, and my left leg and knee was full of shrapnel.
What was your mental state like? Because you'd been very badly shocked from, understandably, after what had happened. Had you recovered at all? Or?
I think by this time I must have still been in shock, but I was compos mentis and knew exactly what was going on around me, and my one issue was to keep safe. And after a while, another tank came by, saw me out in the open, and came over to me and said, "What the hell are you doing here?" And I said, "Having an afternoon cup of tea, you silly bugger." And he said, "Well, I'm sorry, old chap." He said, "I'm going into action now. But on my way back, I'll come pick you up and take you back when I go back for more shells." So I said, "Well, don't get lost." And a few other adjectives. And away he went. An hour and a half to 2 hours.
Now, what was that hour and a half to 2 hours like for you?
Hell on earth, watching the shells drop all around me, but none too close. And I suppose I'm just wondering, like all times you think about the things you've done and the things you would like to do, but there was an element of fear, of course, because you didn't know what was going to happen. But he did come back.
Had you given up at all? Because 2 hours is a long time on your own, you know. So
yes. No, I hadn't given up. I think my mind was too full of wondering
You hadn't been able to improve your position. You were still just behind.
No, just lying behind this tank track.
Now, one thing I forgot to ask is, had anyone on the tank noticed you'd fallen off? I should have asked that earlier.
Well, of course, I don't know, because the tank was in motion when I fell off, and they had gone completely out of sight. I believe I have since read that they said that I disappeared. I would say definitely the wrong adjective. But that is the way they saw it. I certainly didn't get off of my own volition. And
now, after after 2.5 hours, hours or so, the tank came back. Did you see it approaching?
Yes, I thought heaven had opened up, and I only prayed in the very first instance that it wasn't a German tank, because when they're heading towards you, they all look the same. And it came over. One of the crew got out, lifted me on, made me safe, and drove me back.
Lifted you? Did they actually bring you inside, or?
No, on the top. But I believe he must have been very brave, because he kept the turret open and made sure that I was safe the whole time. And he drove me back.
Was it not painful with your legs on a bumping, jolting tank?
Oh, it was, yes. But I think the joy of being picked up, the hope of returning back to my own lines, was overall of all pain that was there. It was a feeling of relief. They dropped me off at a first aid post where there was a doctor, I'm very happy to say. He examined my wounds, dressed, gave me some painkillers.
Do you know what they were? Well, I mean, was it morphine?
Not a clue. Not a clue. I know I felt an awful lot better when he had finished.
Did they write anything on your forehead?
I can't remember that, but was it? The thing they did do was to stick a luggage label on my tunic, which the doctor had written on. And he said, we're going to get you back to the lines. When I looked, it said, amputation right femur. That put a shockwave through me. Think that I was going to lose my right leg. So, after a while, the only vehicle that he could get hold of, because there were no ambulances there, because they'd gone off before and none had come back, was a three-tonner. And he said, this will have to do, and passed me out, and two others, passed me out, lifted me up on this truck. And you can imagine my concern when I found it was ammunition. Lying on the top of a truckload of ammunition, unable to move from the waist down, wasn't my idea of a good time. But we traveled north towards Sidi Rezegh. When we got to the main road, which goes right across from Sidi Rezegh to Brook, all the vehicles were travelling to the west, away from Sidi Rezegh. And a military policeman asked the driver, where the hell do you think you're going? And the driver said, to Sidi Rezegh. He said, are you tired of living? It's full of Germans. Which we turned around and joined the queue of traffic travelling west towards Tobruk.
Eventually, they dropped us off at a hospital, which we found was a South African hospital. The doctor looked at my wounds.
Now, just to interrupt, on your way, there was a Stuka attack. Could you tell us about that?
Oh, yes,
that was.
I'm sorry, yes. On our way, and in well into the open, a Stuka came across and started to dive bomb. And if one has ever been in close proximity of a Stuka, they screech like a wounded animal when they're diving. And he started to bomb. Only God knows how I managed to get off that vehicle with no use in my legs, but I did. I must have dropped off it. But hid behind the vehicle, over the side of the vehicle, and when you look back, absolutely bloody ridiculous that you hide behind over the side of a 3-tonner load of ammunition. I might just as well have sat on the top and waited. I wouldn't have felt anything.
Did the bombs drop nearby? Or?
Not terribly close, no.
Were there other vehicles that the Stuka was after
there
as well?
There weren't many around us. There were one or two, but not many. We seemed to be way out in the open.
So the Stuka just missed?
Yes.
This was after you'd seen the military policeman, was it, when it was on your way back to Tobruk, or before?
No, it was before we'd seen the military policeman.
On your way to Sidi Rezaeg,
then? On the way to Sidi Rezaeg. Then, when we hit the main road, which runs from Sidi Rezaeg to Tobruk, was the incident I mentioned.
Do you remember much about the rest of the journey from when you started to head towards Tobruk along the main road? Were you still conscious?
I was still conscious, but there was really no great incident that is worth recalling.
Did you worry about your leg?
Yes, it was a constant worry to me the whole time, because my mind was running over what I would do if and whenever I got home with one leg, because I really loved dancing, and I couldn't imagine me doing a quick step with my leg. And I suppose a million other things were going through my mind.
What happened when you got to Tobruk?
Well, before I got into Tobruk, the South African doctors just looked at me, redressed my legs, and said, sorry, you're a Brit. You must go into the 42nd British General Hospital, which is inside Tobruk.
Can I just check something? Because Brit's quite a modern term. Is that sort of re-saying what they'd say? But just to
no,
check.
I suppose it's really my modern way of saying British, but I doubt whether he actually said Brit. But that being said, he got an ambulance to take us into Tobruk, behind the perimeter. And we eventually ended up at the British General Hospital, which was the 42nd, I believe. And we were lined up in a corridor, all on stretchers, of course.
On the floor?
On the floor. And gradually, the queue for the it wasn't a surgery, it was a great big hall. And as you were on your stretcher, so you were placed across two tables, trestles, 6-foot tops, plonked on these 6-foot tables. And that was the operating table.
Were there many doctors or nurses in evidence?
No, there were no nurses at all. There was one doctor, and I think he was just another person, REMC, helping him. Pardon me. And whilst I was laying there on this trestle waiting to be seen to, he was operating in this large room, which, no theatre, it was a large room. and the screen would go around the trooper or whoever it was, and the doctor would operate. And every now and again you'd hear a clonk in a bucket where some physical part of the body had been sawn off, and you could hear the actual sawing. And by the time he got to me, knowing full well what the first aid post doctor had written on my label, amputation right femur, I was beginning to get very, very uptight. When he eventually got to me and put the screen round me, he said, "Well, you're the last. I've been operating now for 24 hours, I'm dog tired, and I couldn't do any more." And the anaesthetist, if that's what you would call him, was standing at my head behind me. And believe it or not, he was a padre. And I said to the doctor, "Doctor, as I'm your last patient, I wonder if you could spare a little time to see if you can save my leg. Obviously, I would be very, very grateful." And he said, "All right, young man, I will see what I can do. As you are the last, I will spend a bit of time." The padre, who was about to put the thing over my nose, like the hood, I suppose, and the ether drops, which they used in those barbaric days, said to me, "Now go to sleep, think of your wife." And I said, "I'm not married, padre." He said, "Well, think of your fiance." I said, "I'm not engaged, padre." "Just think of your girlfriend." "So I haven't got a girlfriend." His remark was, "Think of somebody's bloody wife," which rather shook me from coming from the padre. But by this time, I was goner. I was out. And how long it was, I can't remember, but I woke up in bed. I sat bolt upright, dived with my hands down the bed to see if I'd got two legs. And I was very grateful to find that I did have two legs. And with that, and I suppose a great satisfaction, I went straight back and straight out to sleep again. And another 4 or 5 hours before I woke up, and the nurses came, looked at me, and I believe I had a cup of tea, but that was a very drowsy time. I can't remember much about it. I remember that night Jerry bombed to Brook. And they were very close to the hospital. Those that could get out of bed did, and went somewhere, I presume, more secure than they were in the ward. I think I'm right in saying I stayed there 2 nights, and we were taken from there because Jerry was getting closer to Tobruk by that time. An ambulance driven by an American volunteer. And we drove way, way down along the coast road towards Egypt. Pulled into a tented hospital, which, not an operating hospital or anything like that, just patients on their way back. And stayed the night there, and because of the bombing, etc., we had to stay 2 nights. But the second night, there's a poor young German boy who had his leg amputated. I spoke to him in German, which he was very grateful for, and said he was going to try and escape. I said he'd be a silly chap if he did, but he was determined to try. And on the second night, he dragged himself out and obviously didn't get very far and was hauled back. But he was all right.
Had you warned the staff of what he'd said, or did you just regard it as ridiculous?
No, I disregarded it. We just chatted a little bit, and away he went.
Did you feel any enmity towards the Germans? I mean, they had just killed your major, and you know.
Absolutely none. He was another soldier, and from where I was standing, he could have been a Brit. I wouldn't have treated him any differently.
What about your legs? How were they at this stage?
Well, I could feel them, but I couldn't do anything with them. I was lying on my back, absolutely immobilized. But there was feeling.
What about mentally? You'd been through an appalling experience inside that armoured car. I mean, were you having any problems that you were aware of at the time?
Oh, yes. I couldn't sleep. That was one thing. I just couldn't sleep. Until I was so worn out that I went into... No, doctors would have an answer for it.
Why couldn't you sleep? Was it just...
The memory of the headless bodies in my armoured car and the loss of my OC, Ivor Birkin.
Gary.
Yeah, that's Gary, who was a wonderful person. He certainly didn't deserve what he got. I'm not sure whether I mentioned way back that he had given me a little gold jewel, a traveller's saint.
Saint Christopher.
Saint Christopher. And he said he hoped that would guide me and guard me, because I needed it. And I think he meant it in a Christian sense. But I had this round my neck, and it certainly had done that. But as I said, I've been thinking of the carnage inside my armored car, which was to stay with me for a very long time, and it was this that each night they gave me a sleeping draught to put me to sleep.
So you were in this camp. You stayed an extra night.
Yes, we stayed an extra night. And then we were taken further down the line in an ambulance to a railhead. For the life of me, I can't think of the name of that railhead.
Would it be Mersa Matru?
I think you're right. I think it was Mersa Matru. Where there was another hospital. We didn't go into it, but they loaded some of the troops from that hospital on the same train as they loaded us on, and away we went. And I do remember one thing, that on our way, yes, that's right, on our way, and obviously we're travelling east towards Egypt, some American Grant tanks passed us.